Ladies and gentlemen of the bench and bar of the nation, 180 years ago, President George Washington delivered the first State of the Union message to a joint session of the Congress. That was an historic occasion. Believing that knowledge of the judicial system, its needs, its problems, its aspirations, is essential in a free society, the American Bar Association has urged that the Congress promptly provide for a State of the Judiciary message by the Chief Justice of the United States whenever that becomes appropriate. Pending that time, which I hope is not far away, the Chief Justice has agreed to present his messages at meetings of the Association as the authentic spokesman for the legal profession of America. This will once again then today be an historic occasion as we hear the first State of the Judiciary message in the history of our country. Ladies and gentlemen, the Chief Justice of the United States.
Mr. President Siegel, distinguished guests, and members and friends of the American Bar Association. When President Siegel and the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association invited me to discuss the problems of the federal courts with you as legal leaders of the legal profession, my mind turned at once to one of the great statements of the problems of the administration of justice. That, of course, was Dean Roscoe Pound's famous speech to this association at your meeting exactly 64 years ago this summer. Pound, you will remember, was then the very young dean of Nebraska's law school and later to become the great dean of Harvard and one of the outstanding figures in American law. He said then that the work of the courts in the 20th century could not be carried on with the methods, the machinery, and the means of the 19th century. Judges and lawyers did not heed Pound's warning. And today, in the final third of this century, we are still trying to operate the courts with fundamentally the same basic methods, the same procedures, and the same machinery that he said were not good enough in 1906. In the supermarket age, we are, with few exceptions, operating the courts with Cracker Barrel, corner grocer methods and equipment, vintage 1900. My responsibility today is to say to you frankly and even bluntly what I think is wrong with our system and machinery and what can and must be done to correct it in order to make it work. The changes and improvements we need are long overdue. They will call for a very great effort, and they may cost money. But if there are to be higher costs, they will still be only a small fraction, for example, of the $200 million cost of one C-5A airplane, since the entire cost of the federal judicial system for 1 year, for the next year, is less than one of those planes. It is $128 million. Military aircraft are, of course, important, essential in this uncertain world, but so is adequate support for the judicial branch. More money and more judges alone is not the primary solution to the problems of the courts. Some of what is wrong is due to the failure to apply the techniques of modern business to the management of the purely mechanical operation of the courts, of modern record keeping, and systems planning for handling the movement of cases. Some is also due to antiquated and rigid procedures which not only permit delay but encourage it. I hope I can provoke debate, even controversy over these things, to explore and test what I have to say. With increasing urgency, my distinguished predecessors from Chief Justices Taft and Hughes to Chief Justice Earl Warren have pressed these matters vigorously. But today, I place this burden squarely on you, the leaders of the legal profession, and on all judges. If the 144,000 lawyers in the 1,700 state and local bar associations will act promptly, you can prevent a breakdown in the work of the federal courts. In the federal courts today, the problem areas are essentially in the large cities. Here we find in the judicial system no more than a reflection of the complexities of modern life. The problems exist where the action is. How did this present situation come about in the face of numerous additional judgeships provided by Congress over the last 30 years? When we look back, we can see three key factors that account for it. First, the legal profession did not act on Dean Pound's warnings when he said that they had to bring, that we had to bring the methods up to date. Second, all the problems he warned about have become far more acute by the increase in population of this country from 76 million in 1900 to 205 million at the present. Third, many new kinds of cases have been added because of laws passed by Congress, decisions of courts, and the needs of a changing society. In this century, wars and social upheaval and the inventiveness of man have complicated our individual lives and society. The automobile, for example, did more than change the courting habits of American youth. It paved the continent with concrete and blacktop. It created the most mobile society on earth, with all the dislocations and frictions that go with it. And it led people from rural areas to crowd the unprepared cities. The same automobile also maimed and killed more of our people than all of the wars in that time, and brought into the courts thousands of cases that did not even exist in 1900. All this ferment of wars, of increased movement of people, congestion in the cities, contributed to an enormous increase in crime, and criminal cases, once a stable figure in the federal courts, increased. And to make it worse, it now takes twice as long as it did 10 years ago to move a criminal case from the day of the indictment to the day of the sentence. And after that, there are the appeals. To illustrate these changes, consider just a few figures with me. From 1940 to 1970, personal injury cases multiplied 5 times. Petitions from state prisoners seeking federal habeas corpus release increased from 89, to over 12,000 last year, 1,400 times as many. And during this period, Congress increased the number of judges by 70%, while the total of all cases filed in the federal courts nearly doubled. But the increase in the volume of cases is not by any means the whole story. Experienced trial judges note that the actual trial of the case now takes twice as long as it did 10 years ago, because of the closer scrutiny we now demand of confessions, identification witnesses, and evidence. We must do that before we deprive any person of his freedom. These changes represent a deliberate commitment to values which are higher than pure efficiency when we're dealing with human liberty. The impact of all these new factors, and they are many and complex, has been felt in both state and federal courts. A few illustrations as to the federal courts may help. The Criminal Justice Act of 1964 guaranteed a lawyer for criminal defendants, a public expense, of course, for the indigent, and along with it, appeals at public expense. The Bail Reform Act of 1966 authorized liberal release before trial without the conventional bail bond. Each of these acts was an improvement on the existing system. But we can now see what was produced by the interaction of these two laws in a period when crime was increasing. The impact was most notable in Washington, D.C., for example, where federal courts handle all the felony cases. With a lawyer provided to secure release without bail, most persons indicted, except in capital cases, are released pending trial. We should not be surprised that a defendant out on bail exerts a heavy pressure on his lawyer to postpone the trial as long as possible so as to remain free. Now, if trials were held promptly and swiftly completed, and if appeals were heard without delay, this would be less of a problem, and perhaps even these heated debates over preventive detention would disappear. But these two acts of Congress, good acts, came in a period when other forces, including decisions of the courts, were making trials longer, appeals more frequent, and retrials commonplace. Being human, the defendant plays out the line which society has cast him. And lawyers are competitive creatures, and the American system encourages contention and often rewards delay. No lawyer wants to be called on to defend a charge that he was incompetent for having failed to exploit all the procedural techniques which we have deliberately made available. Yet the most experienced defense lawyers know that the defendant's best interest may be served in most cases by a guilty plea without a trial. A new category of cases was added when it was decided that the claims of state prisoners testing the validity of a state conviction were to be judged by federal constitutional standards. As a result of that decision, federal district courts were obliged to review, as I have already said, 12,000 petitions last year as compared with 89 in 1940. If the states will develop adequate procedures for their own state prisoners, this problem will largely disappear, and we will eliminate a major source of friction and irritation between the state and the federal systems. But there is another factor. It is elementary in the system of courts that the number of judges, prosecutors, bailiffs, clerks, court reporters, and courtrooms has been based on the premise that approximately 90% of all the defendants will plead guilty, leaving only 10% more or less to be tried. But that premise may no longer be a reliable yardstick of our needs. Notice that what may seem even a small percentage change in the rate of guilty pleas can have a tremendous impact on the courts. A reduction from 90% to 80% in guilty pleas, for example, requires the assignment of twice as many judges. A reduction to 70 trebles that demand. This was graphically illustrated in Washington, D.C., when the guilty plea rate dropped to 65%. As recently as 1950, three or four judges were able to handle all the criminal cases in district courts. By 1968, 12 judges out of a total of 15 were assigned to the criminal calendar, and they could barely keep up. Fortunately, few other federal courts had such a drastic change, but to have this occur in the national capital, which ought to be a model for the nation and a showplace for the world, was little short of a disaster. There is a widespread public complaint that the present system of criminal justice does not deter criminal conduct. That is correct. It is correct so far as the crimes which trouble most Americans today. Whatever deterrent effect may have existed in the past has now all but vanished as to those crimes. If ever the law is to have a genuine deterrent effect on criminal conduct, we must make some changes. The simple and obvious remedy is to give the courts the manpower and the tools, including prosecutors and defense counsel, to try criminal cases within 60 days after indictment, and then let us see what happens. I predict it would sharply reduce the rate of crime. Efficiency alone, of course, must never be the controlling test of a system of criminal justice, but the work of the courts can be efficient without jeopardizing basic safeguards. Both the accused and the public are entitled to a prompt trial. The addition of 61 new federal judgeships, district judgeships, by the Congress within recent weeks, bringing the total to 401 for the whole country, is the result of efforts which began 5 years ago. Since it will take time to fill these important positions, and new judges do not reach their peak of efficiency at once, the full impact of these new men will not be felt for a long time. We see, therefore, that the additional judges needed in 1965 were not authorized until 1970. We cannot solve our problems in the courts by meeting needs 5 or more years after they arise. The time to plan for 1975 and 1980 needs is now. And I hope this can be accomplished not simply by adding more judges, but by the more efficient use of judicial manpower and greater productivity. Improved methods, improved machinery, improved management, and trained administrative personnel are the keys to greater productivity of judges. Meanwhile, not a week passes without speeches in Congress and elsewhere and editorials demanding new laws to control pollution, new laws to change the environment, new laws allowing class actions by consumers to protect the public. The difficulty lies in our tendency to meet new and legitimate demands with new laws, but without adequate consideration for the consequences on the courts. This is dramatically illustrated in the current budget of the Office of Economic Opportunity. Congress has granted that program $58 million for legal services alone. That $58 million is a sound commitment to an underprotected segment of our society that Mr. Siegel just referred to. These are people whose rights have suffered because they could not afford lawyers. Few things rankle in the human breast like a sense of injustice. Whether the problem is large or small in the abstract, it is very large to the person afflicted. We should applaud Congress for that step. But stop for a moment and remember that $58 million is almost half of what is allowed for the entire operation of all the federal courts in this country. What all this adds up to is that for at least 50 years now, the federal court system has experienced the combination of steadily increasing burdens while suffering from deferred maintenance of the total judicial machinery. And added to that, much of that machinery and much of our method is obsolete. The foresight of Congress in creating the Federal Judicial Center for Research and Study of Court Problems 2 years ago is one of the few bright spots in the past 30 years, and along with it, the creation of the Institute of Court Management Mr. Siegel spoke of. We must make a choice of priorities. When we want to dance, we must provide the musicians, and the public may well be called upon to pay something more for the federal judicial system to increase its productivity. Neither the costs nor the number of judges can be held down if the caseload is constantly expanded. To prepare for this report to you today, I asked every federal judge in the United States for suggestions and comments. The hundreds of replies reflected the note of frustration and even anguish at the daily management and administrative burdens that drain time and energy from their primary task of judging and deciding cases. That was the common denominator, the common complaint from them. Federal judges today are in much the same position of members of Congress a generation ago before their Reorganization Act, which gave them adequate staffs for themselves and for their committees. The business of litigation is highly complex. To assemble all the necessary individuals is not as simple as it appears on the TV shows. It actually involves the very difficult task of bringing together a judge, 25 or more prospective jurors, the lawyers, the witnesses, court reporters, bailiffs, and others, at the same time and at the same place without lost motion. The absence or the tardiness of a single person will delay the entire process and waste untold time. Countless citizens serving as jurors have been irritated because they spend most of their time watching television in the jurors' lounge, if they have a television set there, rather than hearing cases in the courtroom. The management of busy courts calls for careful planning, definite systems, organization, with supervision by trained administrator managers. In the past 10 years, this country has trained 58 astronauts capable of flying in outer space, but we do not have that many court administrators available in this country to serve the courts. The federal courts need, and they need it immediately, a court executive or administrator for each of the 11 circuits and for every busy trial court. We need them to serve as the traffic managers, in a sense, as hospitals have used administrators for the past 40 years to relieve doctors and nurses of management duties. We are almost a half century behind the medical profession. In our basic principles, it is indeed important that we maintain our links with the past and build carefully on those foundations, because they are the result of thousands of years of human experience in the evolution of the law. There is great value in stability, predictability, and continuity, but the procedures and the methods of the law ought to respond more swiftly. Hospitals, doctors, farmers, and businessmen have changed their methods, and we must change ours and bring them up to date. The widespread growth of judicial seminars and institutes and study centers have contributed much to the improvement in recent years, and we owe a very great debt to my colleague, Justice Tom Clark, who has worked tirelessly on these improvements both for the federal and the state courts, and I applaud him for it. The price we are paying and will pay is partly because judges have been too timid and the bar has been too apathetic to make clear to the public and the Congress the needs of the courts. I intend to be neither timid nor apathetic about this. Let me list some of the major steps for the future, and they ought to begin at once. The friction in relations between the state and the federal courts presents a serious problem. In both the review of the state prisoner petitions and other cases, I strongly urge that each state create a state-federal judicial council to maintain continuing communication on all joint problems. In some states, this has already begun. Next, the state and federal judges should continue their cooperation with the American Bar Association to establish standards of conduct for lawyers and judges that will uphold public confidence in the integrity of the system we serve. Next, we should urgently consider, and this is extremely important, a recommendation to Congress to create a judiciary council of perhaps 6 members, 1/3 appointed by each of the 3 branches of government, to act as a coordinating body to report to the Congress, the President, and the Judicial Conference on a broad range of matters affecting the courts. Next, over the years, various statutes and decisions of the courts have altered many aspects of criminal procedure. Since Congress is right at this moment considering an entirely new federal criminal code, we should very soon undertake a comprehensive re-examination of the whole criminal procedure so that we can establish adequate guidelines which will reflect adjustment both to the new code, to judicial holdings, and to take into account new procedural developments made in the states. Next, the system of justice must be viewed as a process embracing every phase from crime prevention at the beginning through arrest, trial, and the correctional system. We can no longer limit our responsibility to providing defense services for the judicial process alone and yet continue to be miserly with the needs of correctional institutions, probation, and parole systems. Next, the whole process of appeals must be re-examined. It is cumbersome. It is costly. It takes too long. Finality of decision at some point is essential to any rational and workable system of justice. Next, we made a wise choice in this country in guaranteeing a lawyer in every serious criminal case, but we must take another step. We must now make certain that these lawyers are adequately trained and that the representation of defendants is on a high professional basis. It is professional advocacy we promise, professional advocacy, nothing more. This association has provided lawyers with comprehensive and authoritative standards, and it is now up to the courts and the bar to make sure those standards are followed. I have necessarily left out in this brief time many important subjects and left others undeveloped, but I hope I have imparted to you a sense of urgency on the problems and the needs of the courts. I hope also that I have made my point that this is primarily better management, better methods, and better trained personnel, not simply more judges. A sense of confidence in the courts is absolutely imperative to maintain the fabric of ordered liberty for a free people. And 3 things could destroy that confidence. 1, that people come to believe that inefficiency and delay will drain even a just judgment of its value. One, that people have, who have long been exploited, come to believe that the courts cannot vindicate their legal rights from fraud and overreaching in the smaller daily transactions of life. One, that people come to believe that the law, in the larger sense, cannot fulfill its primary function to protect them and their families in their homes, at their work, and on the streets. I have great confidence in our basic legal system and its foundations, in the dedicated people in the judicial system, and in the lawyers of America. I believe they all accept the idea that continuity with change is the genius of the American system, and that both continuity and change are essential to fulfill the promise of equal justice under law. If we want to maintain these crucial values, and I am sure we do, we must make some changes in our methods and in our machinery and in our procedures. And I ask your help, the help of every lawyer in America, to see that this is done. Thank you.
That concludes the Chief Justice's report on the American judicial system.